This is Where We Live.
And now DeSean Jackson, as you say, is back. And there will be 12 seconds when the ball is snapped into the hands of Matt Dodge. He has worked harder on trying to receive the snap from Zach Diassi. And that group will have to pull this one off.
And I don't think Tom Coughlin's real comfortable asking Matt Dodge to directional kick. I mean, he can bomb it. But even Tom Coughlin said, you know, trying to angle it and ask him to do certain things at this stage of his career is difficult for him. So in all likelihood, DeSean Jackson's going to at least get a return.
And it's a line drive kick. Jackson bobbles it and now has to try and recover. DeSean Jackson gets a block. Are you kidding? DeSean Jackson. Still not in, and now in for the touchdown, no flags. Unbelievable.
Now, I'm not playing that to rub it in for Giants fans who are already suffering through a horrible season, but instead to illustrate the tiny thresholds by which America's game is decided. An inch or two off center on the punter's foot, a bobbled ball that spins one way out of DeSean Jackson's hands and not the other way. That story kicks off a new book by science evangelists Anissa Ramirez and Alan St. John called Newton's Football. Today, we'll tackle the game and the science behind it with Ramirez. Newton's Football, the science behind America's game, comparing behavior of coaches to monkeys, among other things. We're really not surprised by that. If you want to join our conversation about America's favorite game, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Maybe even some Giants fans will call in after that introduction. You can always email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. Coming up later, we'll also look ahead to the Winter Olympics with the biomechanics of figure skating. But first, let's welcome back Anissa Ramirez. She is a scientist, formerly of Yale University, named one of the top 100 young innovators for a contribution to transforming technology. Great to see you again, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So we started with that because that's how the book starts off. And this one little tableau that we play out here, and people who love football have seen this now 100 times, this punt return for a touchdown. But the reason that you use this example is because it's just the little tiny differences between the ball going one way and the other way that makes football so amazing. Tell us a little bit more about why you chose that story to start out this book.
We chose that story for this chapter we call The Divinely Random Bounce of the Prolate Spheroid. And prolate spheroid is just a highfalutin way to say football, or the shape of the football. And as you say, you can have a random bounce that just goes in one direction, and it totally changes the way the game's going to be. And what's so wonderful about football is that there's lots of strategy, but then there's also these little fine things that happen just that make it so exciting, this randomness, which we talk about in the book. And this randomness that I'm talking about is part of this field of science called chaos theory. So we're actually proposing in Newton's Football that chaos theory is also at work on the gridiron.
Chaos theory at work on the gridiron. Tell me a little bit more about this. I mean, how chaotic is it? It seems chaotic when we're watching it, but how much does chaos theory play into what we see every day?
Well, if you want to teach your child about chaos theory, get a football and drop it. And predict before you drop it where it's going to go. Mm. It might go to the left. It might go to the right. It might bounce. It might not bounce. It might take many different paths. So the shape of the ball creates an opportunity for chaos. You can just, the way that you hold the ball, it could be the same, but you could be slightly off, and that's going to change the trajectory of the where the ball's going.
So of course, the football bouncing around on the field is one of those things. You never know where it's going to go. But what I find so interesting about this sport and how that plays in is that, well, back in the day when football first started, and we'll talk a bit about the evolution of the game in a moment, it was a game that was played by ragtag guys on a ragtag field with a ragtag-looking ball. It was not scientific at all. But this game has become so scientific. Every single player is judged in so many different ways. There are so many ways in which the game is controlled. But what I find interesting about this play and this idea is that something that is so finely tuned can completely go haywire just because of one very, very random act. That's what I think makes football so interesting. It's something that we seem to have a real good grip on until we don't.
That's right. It's exciting. I mean, we have all kinds of data about football players. There's people who can rattle off all kinds of stats about the football players. And we know all about different plays. And these guys are warriors. When you throw the ball, you know exactly where it's going to go. You know, people know exactly where they're supposed to be. However, they're reduced to kindergartners when we drop the ball. Recovering the fumble is huge. In fact, we talk about in the book how two teams who were kind of the same, but they had different percentages in the number of fumbles and recovering fumbles, and one team went off to do better. So that's one of the last knobs, if you will, to have a better team, which is to control chaos. Controlling chaos gives you a chance to be a champion.
If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266, we're talking with scientist Anissa Ramirez, whose book is Newton's Football, The Science Behind America's Game. If you have questions about football, if you're a big football fan and you have some questions about the way it runs the way it does, and we've got so many, I've got so many for you, but let's talk first about the evolution of football as a sport. How exactly it grew into this game that we have today?
Well, football, it's called the pigskin. And the reason why it's called the pigskin is that it actually comes from a pig's bladder. Pig's bladder is actually quite elastic, and if you blow it up, you get this strange shape, which is what the football kind of looks like today. And it initially started off as a game closer to rugby, where you would carry the ball. But then it started getting more of a pointed nose because it was easier to tuck it, but also easier to throw it. And so it's the shape of the ball that has changed with the game, but also changed how the game is played.
It changed how the game is played over the years. When the football got a little bit smaller, it became something that you could throw more easily in this spiral formation, something that, you know, early on people hadn't exactly perfected. But once you could throw the football in a way that it would cut through the air downfield, it changed the game completely. And I think this is an important evolution in the sport. When it was something that was really a ground game, you relied on different sorts of players and different sorts of tactics. As soon as you can chuck it 40 yards down the field, it becomes a completely different sport.
Absolutely, and you need different types of players. When we were on the ground and the ball stayed mostly on the ground, you needed generalists, you need big guys who could move around. But now we need really fast guys who can get down to the end of the field. So it changes the type of player you need as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those players and how they've changed. There's so much made about performance-enhancing drugs in sport. There's so much that's made about just the size of the people that we're talking about here. If you've never stood next to an NFL player, you don't really know what I'm talking about. But these are huge, huge men, men who really, in some ways, defy gravity.
They have more, it feels like gravity, or maybe they may have their own gravitational pull. They're pretty huge. And, you know, we looked at how the size of the football player has changed. In 1929, there was a gentleman who was over 300 pounds. He was the only one. Now we have almost 500 players that are 300 pounds. These guys are huge.
They're very, very huge. So what does that do to the game itself when you have so many people who are so big against so many other people who are also so big? It does set up some interesting physics experiments, doesn't it? And I mean, it's not as though you've got a 300-pound guy going against a 150-pound guy all the time. You actually have 350 or 400-pound almost men beating each other up in a very, very confined space. Some people wonder, is there enough room for all these big guys to run around on this tiny little field?
Well, I think that's part of the design. If you have bigger people in a smaller amount of space, you're going to have more collisions. And let's face it, football is a game of collisions. What ends up is that these big guys are actually quite fast. They're faster than I am. And so when we look at the physics of the game, there's two parameters that you can have: how fast they are and how much they weigh. M and V. And if you look at it, if Sir Isaac Newton was to look at this game, he would choose a player based on how heavy they are and how fast they are. And in the book, we propose that Aaron Gibson would probably be his selection because that guy is huge. He's 387 pounds and can do a 5-4. And that's a lot of force, and that's a lot of momentum. And so it's a game of momentum. It's people who are relatively the same speed, but the last thing that we can change is the weight, and that's why these guys are getting bigger and bigger.
But then there's this other thing that football has that a lot of other sports don't. In some sports, you can have more or less a group of guys who are about the same size. But in football, you need a variety of different sorts of players. You need 350-pound players, and then you need really, really fast guys. And one of the interesting things about football in recent years is it seems as though there is this difference between somebody who runs the 4-4-40 and the 4-3-40, and somehow or other that 4-3 guy actually has an enormous advantage. Just looking at the raw numbers, it doesn't seem like they would, but these little tiny fractions actually matter quite a bit, don't they?
It certainly makes a difference because there's a limit to how fast we as humans can go without any kind of assistance. So faster guys definitely get bigger bucks.
They get much bigger bucks. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I think when we talk about the players, this idea of players taking painkillers, of players trying to figure out new ways to get ahead of the curve, what in studying the game have you learned about that? I mean, do you think, as many people wonder, that people are putting themselves at some sort of risk by playing a game that involves so much drug taking, whether or not it's legal drug taking or illegal drug taking, in order to become these physical specimens that they are?
Well, the gains are huge. I mean, you get a fantastic life. You've got you'll get all kinds of favors that come towards you if you are an NFL player. So people are willing to make that leap, and so they're willing to do everything it can to make that happen. And yes, there's definitely a lot of painkillers and people using performance-enhancing drugs so that they can maximize this opportunity. You know, a career for a football player is only a few years. And so people want to maximize how much pay they're going to make so that they can live off that for the rest of their lives.
Are these sort of genetic marvels that we're watching on an NFL field, are they products of evolution in some way?
They're sort of like supermodels. Supermodels are also kind of freaks of nature in the other direction. So, yeah, they're huge specimens. They're big, fast guys. Usually you get big and slow, or you get fast and small, but these are big, fast guys. So it's definitely they've evolved in a different way.
What about the equipment that the players are wearing today? Obviously, in the last few weeks even, an awful lot has been made about the rash of concussions in the National Football League, whether or not the NFL knew that this was a problem going years back, and what they're trying to do to solve this problem right now. Some people say, well, the better equipment is going to help keep you from getting a concussion. And in your book, you suggest, well, maybe this better equipment actually makes it a little worse. You have people who have really hard plastic helmets crashing into one another at very high speeds.
Well, this is a very good question, and I'm glad we're going to talk about it. There's a book that came out recently, and it pretty much states that 1994 was the year of the concussion, where and who knew what when. But in our book, we say, look, the year of the concussion, that's irrelevant. We set up this problem long, long time ago. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of the helmet. The helmet was designed to prevent skull fractures. About 100 years ago, people were dying from the game of football. They were wearing leather heads, and they were crashing into each other, and they were splitting their heads open, literally, and dying. And so Teddy Roosevelt came in and set up some regulations and saved the game. And he did so, and in that way, we also had helmets that came along, and helmets were once again designed to prevent people from splitting their heads open. Now, around the 40s or so, there was a gentleman, Otto Graham, who was a quarterback, and he was wearing one of these helmets, and he got his face pretty beat up. And so his coach said, look, I don't want this guy to get beat up. I'm going to give him this plastic face mask to protect his face. The face mask soon became adopted, and when the face mask was adopted, players started to feel like they were more invincible. See, when you had a helmet, you were protecting your skull, but you weren't going to really use your head because you still could get a broken nose or break your jaw or whatever. But once we got the face mask, we started using our heads. And that happened in the 40s and 50s. And so that set this up for this concussion problem because the helmet was never designed to mitigate concussions.
All of the pads that the players wear on their shoulders and on their hips and on their legs, all over them, it seems as though it makes them more impervious to this pain, these broken bones. So you're really making the case that if we went back to the rugby days of no helmets at all, maybe we wouldn't have so many concussions?
Well, if we went back, one of the chapters we have is, should we ban helmets? And it's a good question. But if we ban helmets, it's a totally different game. It's going to be rugby, and it's probably not going to be as exciting as it is. So I do think we have to keep asking these questions. I think it's better helmets. There are people who make fantastic helmets for other sports that are much more dangerous, like race car driving. And those helmets, they're more expensive, but they're more capable of mitigating some of these injuries. So it might take a new type of helmet.
What do you think about this change that the NFL has made in the last year or so, or the last few years, to try to just change the way people tackle? Do you think that NFL players, from what you've witnessed over the years, are really going to change so much their behavior, not hit each other with their heads, try to tackle in a way that's going to be a little bit less stressful for their heads and for other people's knees, for instance?
Yeah, well, this is a shout-out to Bobby Hosea, but he has methods of new ways of tackling where you don't use your head. He trains children how to do this so that they are better players down the road. I remember him having one type of hit. He calls it the Shamu, where you kind of arch your back. If you remember the whale from SeaWorld, he has his arched back, so his head is out of the way. So you can hit and make sure that your head is not part of that collision as well. So we're definitely going to need new ways of tackling as well.
Anissa Ramirez is a science evangelist, and her brand new book is called Newton's Football, which she wrote with Alan St. John, The Science Behind America's Game. When we come back from our break, we're going to take some more of your phone calls, and we're also going to hear a little bit about game theory, about how coaches use risk or don't in the NFL. If you've got questions, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with Dr. Anissa Ramirez, who's a science evangelist who's been on our program before. And her new book is called Newton's Football, The Science Behind America's Game, co-written with Alan St. John. We're taking a look at America's favorite sport and some of the things that make it great and make it a little confusing at times, including coaches and the way they decide to coach the game. We're going to get to that in just a moment. 860-275-7266 if you're a football fan and want to join us in conversation about the science behind the game. Before we move on from head injuries, one of the things I guess I've always wondered that you try to answer in this book is, look, football players knock heads all the time, and what we're finding is that sustained head trauma over time can cause real serious damage to the human brain. Why is it that a woodpecker can sit up there in my tree in my backyard and whack away for hours on end and not get a concussion?
That's a great question. One of our chapters is called Why Woodpeckers Don't Get Concussions. It's three reasons why woodpeckers don't get concussions. Well, first of all, we don't know if they don't get concussions. Maybe there aren't aspirins that small to help them with that. But woodpeckers have smaller brains. Their brains are about 2 grams. That's the weight of 2 paperclips. Our brains are about 1,400 grams, so that's 1,400 paperclips. So a bigger head is going to have more forces on it. The second thing is a woodpecker has its brain tilted about 90 degrees, so it's actually got more area that's undergoing the force. So more area, more force is spread out. Our brains are, the way they are. There's no way that we're going to change this way our brains are located. So that's not going to help. And the last thing is that woodpeckers have their brains snugly inside of their skull. They're not floating around in a fluid like ours is. And concussions form because the brain itself hits the inside of the skull. Now, if it's tightly fitted, that's not going to happen. But our brains are not in the skull like that. Our brains can slosh around and hit the inside, and that's what causes a concussion.
Okay, so we think woodpeckers don't get concussions. They may very well go on the injured reserve, the woodpecker injured reserve or whatever. We just don't see that.
That's right. But, they peck a lot. 12,000 pecks a day, and then they wake up and do the same thing again.
That's a hell of a job. That's not a job that I would want. So here's one of the things that I've always been interested in, and I'm glad you tackle this in this book, is I'm one of those fans who, when I'm watching a football game, I'm screaming at the television because I always think the coach is wrong. It's because, I think myself and most fans think that we know better than the coach. But I've read some studies in the past, and I know that you go into some of this research as well, that honestly, the way that coaches do make their decisions in-game, probably it is wrong an awful lot of the time. And I guess I'm wondering if we can explain, first of all, why coaches coach the way they do, why they make some of the decisions that they make on the field.
Well, we can't blame the coaches. The coaches are human. And we as humans have a propensity to stay away from negative than we do from positive. So what's the number one position of a coach? To win? No. To keep his job. And if you lose a game, you might lose your job. So it's been found in some research that we feel negative situations almost 2.5 times greater than a positive situation. I'll spell that out. If I get $20 for free, that feels great. But if I lose $20, that feels worse. And in fact, it feels 2.5 times worse than if I were to feel excited about it. So coaches and also monkeys have this same tendency. So coaches don't want to lose or they don't want to do things that are innovative because they're afraid of losing their jobs. And that feels worse than being innovative.
Well, so the most important thing you said there, though, is that the thing that we always hear the goal is to win that game isn't actually the long-term goal of the coach. It's to avoid criticism. Today, of course, it's to avoid people beating you up on Twitter and Facebook after the game. So really, you're trying to not lose your job, so you're trying to avoid criticism.
That's right.
Okay, so you want to not take risk, even though If you run the play over and over again in a computer simulation, going for it on fourth and two in the middle of the field, you should really always do it, but yet coaches almost never do.
They almost never do, yeah. And it's because they're afraid of losing their job. Doing something conservative and losing feels less worse than to do something outrageous and losing, even though it might have a strong, even if it feels uncomfortable.
So how does this affect long-term innovation in the game? Because it seems as though every couple of years, somebody comes through with a brand new way of looking at the game. We played a little clip from the beginning of the show in which DeSean Jackson of the Eagles returns this punt against the New York Giants. The Eagles have a new coach this year, Chip Kelly, who's running this entirely new offense. And some people who look at that say he's going to change the sport. Other people, longtime NFL observers, and including those who play the game, say nothing ever changes. The game is always the same. Where do you fall on this axis? I mean, can you inherently change and innovate in a game that has so many variables and has so much history and tradition and people unwilling to change sometimes?
It's a very good question. What we found in the book is that when people are desperate, they're willing to innovate. So the A11 and the Wildcat offense, that's because in one case, we had a school of really skinny kids, and they had to figure out a way to play so that they can win. And in another case, we had a losing team. Now, in the future, I actually think that, in a word, that football will change with analytics. If a coach is disciplined enough to listen to guys who study best plays and best situations because they have all this data, then that will change the game.
So, and just for our listeners who don't understand the terminology, the Wildcat offense is an offense. There's no quarterback in there at all. You snap the ball directly to a running back, and you are going to run the ball, or perhaps he might throw it, but it throws people off. What's the A11 offense?
The A11 offense is essentially a mathematician's dream. You have students, you have kids in different pods. There's no real quarterback, and there's so many eligible players that you don't really know where the ball's going. And the reason why it was created is that these kids were really, really small compared to their competitors. And so they had to figure out how they can get the ball and have many, many opportunities or eligible players to throw the ball to.
So it seems like the sort of thing that in peewee football might work, but in the NFL, somebody would probably sniff that off quickly. Although you have in your book some examples of, say, defensive tactics that seemingly shouldn't really work by traditional metrics, but they actually have worked over time because they essentially changed the number of players who are taking part in any one play. Like Dick LeBeau's offense in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, or defense in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. Explain a little bit about some of the innovations that have actually worked.
Dick LeBeau, zone blitz is also, we say it's very much like quantum mechanics, because there's usually two things. You have coverage and pressure. And you don't know which one is happening. You might have one, and you won't have the other. So the zone blitz takes advantage of this balance, if you will, by throwing you off from which way things will go.
It's essentially more players doing things that you're not expecting to have happen. And this is one of the interesting things about the sport. It seems as though, again, as much as it has changed over the years, there's always someone who's trying to do something a little bit new to get that advantage. And something we see all the time in football is once one team does it and it's successful, and this might just be like the monkeys that were studied before, everyone wants to do that exact same thing, and that becomes the new norm.
That's right. In fact, I mean, in football, it's all about getting a little bit of an advantage. So in the zone blitz, it's about taking advantage of the fact that people always expect people to do one job and then just coming from all different directions. Sam Weish actually took advantage of something that people had ignored, which is the huddle. He had the no-huddle offense. And what that does is that sets it up so if you train your players to play repeatedly, one play after the other, without any rest, they actually build a stamina. However, if the other team is not, they'll be much more fatigued. And so he took advantage of that. By not having a huddle and by getting to the line, the other team was not able to rest and they weren't able to switch out players so that he would be ready to go and make plays accordingly. So it's all about little advantages.
We just have a minute before our break. I should ask you, why were you so interested in doing this book? What got you involved in this?
Well, you know, I grew up with sports fans, but I'm a scientist and I look at things as a system. Why do things happen the way they happen? And so I had the great opportunity to work with Alan St. John, who has an encyclopedia of football facts. And we had some of the best conversations in my life. he would say something about football, and I would say, hey, that's kind of like this, that's science-related, and then I would say something that's science-related, and then he would say something that's related to football. And we said, you know, there's some there's some overlap between these things that are so different, these different domains, science and football, that there must be some universal questions that are going on.
Did you feel like you learned a lot more about the game as you were going through this book?
Absolutely. I didn't know a thing about football. And the fact that I can say zone blitz and kind of know what that is a different Anisa than a year ago.
You sound very convincing. You could end up on, I don't know, sports talk radio.
I know what I'm talking about. But I'm looking at I look at the game differently. I look at it as a system. I look at these little players, these running around, and I can kind of see how they are from a science point of view. And that's what this book is about.
Well, the science point of view comes from Anisa Ramirez, who's a scientist, a science evangelist. And this new book is called Newton's Football, The Science Behind America's Game. When we come back, we'll hear some more from her about the changes in football. We'll also go to the Winter Olympics. We'll try to find out a little bit about the physics behind figure skating. We'll be right back after this break, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the transition from high school to college is tough for just about anyone. But if you're the first in your family to go to college, you are a trailblazer, and you've got a whole new set of challenges, from knowledge of the college application process to financial aid to campus life. We'll be joined by a panel of first-generation college students, both past and present, to share their stories. And you can always share your story here on Where We Live as well. Today, we're talking about sports, and we've been talking about the science behind football with Dr. Anisa Ramirez, who's a science evangelist, who's got a brand new book she co-authored called Newton's Football, The Science Behind America's Game. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment, but we also want to bring in someone who works on a sport that we might take a little bit for granted, figure skating. If you think about it, men and women dancing on the ice on razor-sharp blades, it's kind of crazy. So here to talk about the biomechanics of this Olympic sport is Deborah King, who's associate professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Sciences at Ithaca College and a member of the Sports Science and Medicine Committee of U.S. Figure Skating. Deborah King, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So when you talk about the biomechanics of figure skating, what exactly is it that you're looking at?
Well, I'm looking at several different things. From one aspect, we look at performance, for example, figure skating jumps and how skaters can work with their coaches to learn higher level jumps, maybe a triple or a quad. And then I'm also looking at it from an injury perspective and how we can keep skaters healthy.
So that first piece, these jumps that are almost seemingly impossible to do, I guess I have to ask you from a layman's perspective, how do they do that? How do they jump in the air on the ice and spin around four times and come back down in a perfect landing?
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Obviously, a lot of skill and a lot of practice. I think they can take a little bit of advantage of the ice. You can get going fairly fast on the ice to get some speed up. And they vault up in the air, spin really fast, know where they are, come down and land. It's really an amazing feat.
Well, I was asking Anisa Ramirez about this, and I'd like you to weigh in. Are these physical freaks of nature, people who just are able to naturally do something that the rest of us can't do, or is it about the training or some combination thereof? I mean, what really makes someone able to do this?
I think it's a combination of both. Some of it's going to be a little bit of genetics. Do you have the athleticism you need? And some of it is going to be the people who have the dedication to stick through the training programs and train hard and stay focused and get to the end. So it's definitely going to be a combination.
Anisa Ramirez, I'd like you to weigh in on this, because both on the football field and in the ice skating rink, we're seeing people do things that it seems as though they shouldn't be able to do. Do you think, from a scientific standpoint, Dr. Ramirez, that we're getting close to the limits of the human ability to do some of the things that we see? Are we closing in on the frontier of what humans can actually do?
Well, we always think we're closing on the end of what we can do as humans, and then someone comes along and breaks it. So I'm not going to be the one that, you know, years from now, they're like, hey, Anisa said that was the limit. So I'm not going to have a comment on that. But you know, we're always finding that there's new things. And what we're actually finding in sports is that the next level, particularly for football, the next untamed territory is the brain. Mm. There's an athlete's brain. There's an athletic intelligence. Quarterbacks are now, we're now able to identify quarterbacks not solely on their skill, but their ability to look at the field, know where everyone is going, and be able to throw the ball. It ends up that that's a skill that not all of us have, and that athletes tend to have a higher level of and can develop even faster.
Well, this is interesting. So, Deborah King, what's the analog there for figure skaters? Is there something about a figure skater's brain, especially the people at the very top, that allows them to do what they do beyond all the physical gifts that they have in the training, but something about their brain that's special?
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm not sure that anybody has necessarily studied that with figure skaters, but intuitively, I think I would have to agree that the way perhaps their brain is working and what they're seeing on the ice or their body awareness when they're doing the tricks in the air, that it's not just the physical ability in terms of, say, muscular power or quickness, but their awareness of the situation and where they are as they're skating, I think would make a big difference. And I don't think everyone would have the ability to do that in terms of maybe knowing how to come out of a jump and when to come out of a jump.
Well, I think another thing, though, that we always see, especially when it comes to the Olympic level, is this idea of pressure and what it does to people. The fact is that somebody can be the greatest NFL quarterback, but as soon as some quarterbacks are under extreme pressure, it seems as though they fold, and other people, it seems as though they thrive. Same thing with figure skaters. We've all watched the Olympics in which the person who is favored to win doesn't win because somebody else seems mentally tougher, mentally more able to survive all this pressure. Is there something to that, Deborah King, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Being able to deliver what you can do in practice on the spot, when the moment's big, the Olympic Games, the World Championships, in figure skating, particularly single skating, you're the only person out there. You have the whole ice to yourself with the thousands and thousands of people watching you. So you have to be able to bring it when it counts.
To tell us a bit about what you do for the U.S. Olympic Committee, if you don't mind, so we understand how you're helping them train and learn how to use their bodies to do these amazing things.
Right. So I work with the Sports Medicine and Science Committee, and we work to put programs together for coaches and skaters. I'm particularly involved more in the research aspect, so doing research on figure skaters that will bring back information from more an educational piece that we can give to the coaches. So, for example, when we're studying the jumps, looking at skaters who have mastered, say, a quadruple jump versus those who are still doing a triple, what do we know about making that transition in terms of the physical attributes that the skater needs to do? Would it be the way they move their arms and legs, the way they skate into the jump, the way they jump off the ice, where they open up? What sort of more technical information about the skill can we give back to the coach to help their skater learn the skill?
And this is another thing that has become a big part of the modern game of football, Anissa Ramirez, is this idea that because you can watch on tape over and over again, even watching an NFL Madden football game yourself on a screen making some of these moves, it enables players to figure out the very, very best technique, train to that technique over and over again, and hopefully master that technique. And that's something else that's part of a modern football.
Oh, certainly. But what I want to do is give everyone a tip if you are under a stressful situation, whether you're on the ice or if you're a place kicker. What you have to do is keep your brain busy. If you overthink it, you're going to choke. So what place kickers do is they give themselves a mantra. Maybe they'll say tempo, balance, tempo, balance. Keep your brain occupied, because if you overthink it, all that training is going to go away. Your brain will start to kick in and start messing things up. And that's what we learn when we talk to football players for Newton's Football.
And I know a lot of athletes, this happens with golfers all the time, visualization is key. If your mind can see you doing something, it's amazing how it actually helps you do that thing. I assume it's that way for place kickers in football.
Absolutely. Well, what you do is you keep kicking until you don't even have to think about it, so that you're on autopilot. But the thing that we found was key, you definitely visualize it, but the thing that you have to do is you make sure that you don't think while you're doing whatever the act is.
This idea of visualizing is something I know, Deborah King, that figure skaters do an awful lot. You see them on the ice and they're or just before they get on the ice, and they're listening with their headphones on and they're going through their pre-flight routine, as it were, trying to figure out all the things that they're going to do. This is, I think, something that all the great figure skaters seemingly are able to do, is visualize success before they have success.
Absolutely. And I think you'll see different skaters do it slightly differently. Some skaters you'll see when TV cameras cut to them before they go onto the ice, sort of walking through it both physically and mentally in their head, and other skaters you'll see off maybe sitting down listening to the music and more just mentally thinking through the program.
Now, before I let you go, Deborah King, I'm going to ask Anissa Ramirez about this in a moment, but I'd like to know what you think about the future of figure skating. From your perspective, from a sports sciences standpoint, obviously injuries are a big piece of this. You want to keep people healthy, but people are going to keep coming up with new and more innovative tricks. What do you see as some of the big futures to look forward to in the sport that you work on?
Gosh, I think there are several things. As you mentioned, the injuries are really important, and keeping the skaters healthy as they keep advancing the skills. I think we might start to look at advances in equipment. We don't think of equipment a lot in figure skating, but they're on a skate and a boot, and should those be more lightweight? Should they be more flexible or less flexible? Can something be done legally? You need to stay within the rules that can help them jump faster or skate faster and help them go up to a higher level, but at the same time, keep the injury rates down.
Is there an injury that is particularly bad for figure skaters right now that you're trying to solve?
Well, in terms of chronic overuse injuries, they have a lot of leg injuries in terms of stress fractures and bursitis. And then acute injuries, obviously you're on ice, you're jumping, you fall down. Concussions are a big deal in figure skating, just as you see them in football.
Yeah, and I don't know that we'll ever see figure skaters with helmets on, but you never know. This could be a part of the sport at a certain point. Deborah King is Associate Professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Sciences at Ithaca College. Thank you so much, Deborah, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So, Anissa Ramirez, before we run low on time, what do you see as some of the futures of football here? Because there's obviously injury prevention. This is a big thing. But as you look forward in this game, what do you see?
I see that it will become more and more scientific, that this analytics, the study of best plays at different times, and will be key to football. We already see these things in baseball. Baseball is all about statistics. You can talk to a kid who loves baseball, and they can rattle off all kinds of things. But I think that will be the case for football as well, that we'll listen more to analytics and determine what's the best step based on history, based on a whole bunch of data.
You know, baseball teams have pioneered in the last several years. They've actually put some of these guys, these geeks that they never paid attention to, these sabermetricians, into their front offices. They're hiring people to help the coaches and general managers make decisions based on raw data. Do you see the same thing happening in football? And are the people, sometimes the traditionally very hard-headed people of the football world, ready to accept some of what they're saying?
It's two questions. I do think that the sports geeks are going to be in the front office for football. In fact, it's already happening. I've gone to a couple of meetings, and it's analytics is very key to a lot of different parts of football. But the next part is discipline. Coaches have to listen to these folks so that they know what's the best play. I mean, we do football is all about gut, but sometimes it's about data.
Well, you talked with a bunch of people in the NFL and around football for this book. I guess I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about how you think they respond to a book that is, you know, the science behind America's game. Do they see it that way? Because as scientific as the game has become, when you are around a football coach or around a football practice, there's an awful lot of the same stuff that's been there since the game was first developed, when Teddy Roosevelt was playing the game, which is guts and machismo and people challenging each other physically. It seems as though some of the things that you're writing about are almost at odds with the traditions of the game, which say, let's use our gut. Let's not worry about what the eggheads say. Let's go out and just beat each other over the head. What were you hearing from people when you were talking to them?
Well, the first thing that we got when we spoke to scientists, coaches, players, is that everybody loves the game. And they want the game to survive. And they want to explore all the ways that we can do that. And so there's a couple of different ways that they can do that. The other thing that we found out is that everyone is pretty smart. Now, we always think of athletes in a certain way that they're not smart. No, they're pretty smart. They know about strategy just like a chess master would. They know about how to make things much more efficient. So they've already been acting like it was scientific. It's just that we're just adding some of the words to what they're doing to things that they've already done as a habit. Now, Vince Lombardi, everybody talks about Vince Lombardi. In fact, you know, you can see quotes of him all over. He was actually pretty scientific. In fact, he taught chemistry and physics, so he was a man of science. It's just that he also played things, he played and created plays with the same kind of efficiency that a scientist would, like the sweep is something that he perfected. He had many different variations of it. So I think all we're doing is just adding language to what people are doing already.
A last thing for you, and this is a big part of your book. We talked about helmets earlier and injuries and trying to protect the brain. Obviously, as a scientist, your brain is your most prized possession. Honestly, for all of us, even if we're not scientists, our brain is pretty darned important. I know you've been watching as an outsider in the football world, and now more as an insider as you're putting out this book. This book is coming out just as this other very important book has come out about head injuries in the game, this big frontline special, which people saw on CPTV. Do you see football maybe being in a little bit of trouble because of the types of injuries we're seeing, not just to the brain, but to all parts of the body, to the overuse of drugs, to some of the unbelievable behavior that we seem to be seeing off the field? As someone who loves the game and is learning more about the game as you write about it, do you see football in some sort of trouble, as a lot of Americans seem to right now?
We are in a place that we call in the book, Newton's football, the uncanny valley. We're in a place where you love football, but it's also kind of icky. You love it, but you're also scared. And we've been here before. We've been here 100 years ago with Teddy Roosevelt. And what it does is it takes everyone to come together to figure out what the solution is.
Well, this book is really an interesting look inside the game. It's called Newton's Football, The Science Behind America's Game. It's with Alan St. John and our guest, Anissa Ramirez. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us here on Where We Live.